Welcome to the program. George Bernard Shaw once said something that later became a kind of symbolic message for Robert Kennedy. He said that some men see things as they are and ask why. I dream things that never were and ask why not. In that simple phrase lies perhaps the very foundation of Western culture, the idea that innovation and most of all imagination can reshape the world, that the human mind and human spirit are capable of thinking something up and then, in spite of any obstacles, making it a reality, and that this is as true for going to the moon as it is for curing disease or starting a business. All are part of the rubric that defines hope and progress for civilization. This morning we're joined by a man whose guiding principle has been this very idea. Our guest today, Bill Shaw, is the founding and executive director of Share Our Strength, the nation's leading organization working to end childhood hunger in America. He currently serves on the board of directors of the Timberland Company and of Venture Philanthropy Partners. He's been an adjunct professor at New York University's Stern School of Business and is currently the program advisor for the Reynolds Foundation Fellowship Program at the John F. Kennedy School of Government. It is my pleasure to welcome him here to the program today to talk about his new book, The Imaginations of Unreasonable Men, Inspiration, Vision, and Purpose in the Quest to End Malaria. Bill Shaw, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here on the program. Talk a little bit about your life experience and your trip to Ethiopia in the depth of the famine and how that really inspired you in some unique ways.
Sure. Well, I had started Share Our Strength as a result of the Ethiopian famine in 1984. I'd worked in government and politics before then, but was really struck by this huge humanitarian catastrophe and thought that there'd be a way to do something about it outside of government in the private sector, particularly with people, so much talent in the country that's not involved in politics, if we could find a way to get people involved. And we created an organization called Share Our Strength that worked at the time primarily in the restaurant and food service industry, connecting chefs and restaurateurs, since they made their livelihoods from food, to the issue of hunger. And then at the onset of another very severe famine in Ethiopia in 2000, in the year 2000, actually, I went to Ethiopia. And while there, and this was a really kind of the catalyst for writing The Imaginations of Unreasonable Men, I was in a classroom visiting a school that Share Our Strength was helping to build with a hospital next door to it, and struck up a friendship with a 13-year-old girl. She happened to be the age of my daughter at that time, and that must have been part of the connection. Her name was Alima Dari. She spoke beautiful English. She was a lovely girl, just full of life and promise, and we corresponded for a year and a half afterwards and exchanged photos and so forth. But then when a colleague of mine went over a little while later, he had told me that she had died from cerebral malaria. And I was just stunned because she just, as I say, she seemed so full of life and promise. And we had been building this, the irony is we'd been building this hospital next door. I think of something that Martin Luther King used to say, which is that in this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. And we were too late. And that's given a sense of urgency to everything I do now at Share Our Strength.
Talk about that sense of urgency, because sometimes there's this disconnect between imagination and urgency, that we kind of want to think things up, but there isn't this sense of urgency about them in life. And many times the people that succeed the most effectively are those that combine that sense of imagination and sense of urgency.
I think that's right, and I think a lot of it has to do with being able to put faces and names to issues and problems. So we know, for example, that nearly a million children in Africa die every year from malaria. That's about 3,000 kids a day. But that's just a statistic to most of us. And then you develop a relationship with a young girl like Alima Dari, and you realize just the profound tragedy of that. So I think this ability to kind of bridge the gap between the near and the distant, to be able to put yourself in the shoes of people who are not like you, and have problems unlike yours, that's really the key to a lot of social change. And if you can get people motivated that way, I think you can really have a big impact in the world.
And the other side of the same coin is really that the ability to kind of see out into the future and imagine solutions that may not be on the table right now. I mean, there's certainly been a lot going on with respect to malaria in terms of some of the work with NETS and some of the stuff the Gates Foundation is doing. But the idea that people like Dr. Stephen Hoffman, who you talk about, can jump forward and think that there's a bigger solution to all of this is really the giant leap of imagination.
That's right. I've always believed that most failures are not failures of money, as we tend to think, or failures of timing or planning, but really failures of imagination, that inability to kind of see what is possible. And the toughest problems to solve of all are those that affect people who are so voiceless and so vulnerable that there are no markets for solving them. There's no economic market. There's no political constituency. So you have to have this leap of imagination to say, how are we going to solve that? That's what Steve Hoffman did with malaria for many, many years. Everybody in the scientific and the global health community believed that we could find treatments for malaria, we could find medicines for malaria, maybe we could develop some partially effective vaccines. But the idea of eradicating malaria was not even on the table. It was, in fact, in the malaria community, it was called the E-word, eradicate. Literally, nobody would say it because it seemed such a far-fetched idea. And then Steve Hoffman and others started working on vaccines. Melinda Gates, in 2007, gave a speech saying, actually, we must insist on eradication. And it turns out that that inspired people. That brought more resources to the table. Again, that leap of imagination changed the entire paradigm. We've seen the same thing at Share Our Strength. We, for many, many years, were engaged in providing emergency food assistance to food banks and other organizations. And then we said, well, actually, there's a piece of this issue, at least as it affects children, childhood hunger, that we can solve. Let's end childhood hunger. And nobody had actually thought that that was doable, and I think we're in the process of proving that it is.
One of the unique things with respect to Share Our Strength and at the hunger aspect of this is the realization at some point that it is not a lack of food or a lack of food programs, but in fact the ability to get that out there to the kids that need it that is the leap of imagination in that regard.
That's exactly right. Obviously, in this country, kids are not hungry because of lack of food, or as you say, even lack of food programs. We have school breakfast, we have school lunch, we have summer meals, we have the food stamp program, now called SNAP. But the problem is so many kids are under-enrolled in these programs. Here in California, for example, of all the children that receive school lunch, free or reduced-price school lunch, and that's more than a million kids, only 40% of them get breakfast from the schools because you have to get there earlier, and
right,
there's other logistical. Only 22% of them get meals when the schools are closed in the summertime. So I think what you've said is so important, because many times people think we may not have the solutions to these problems, when in fact we do have the solutions, but we haven't found the ways to make them affordable or sustainable or replicable. That was really the connection that I saw to Steve Hoffman's work in malaria. One of the first things he said to me was, the solution to a malaria vaccine is not scientific discovery, it's biotech engineering. In other words, we know some things that work. We have to figure out how to deliver them to people, how to scale it up, how to make sure it reaches a million kids in Africa.
Talk about the scaling up part of it, because those are the parts of it that take a lot of money. And sometimes we have so many programs going on, and there's a little money here and a little money there and a little money there, and there is not the realization that like it or not, sometimes it's going to take a lot of money, big chunks of money, to accomplish these things.
That's right. As much as I would love to say, and I used to say before I got a little older and wiser, that a little bit goes a long way, one of the things I realized is that, in fact, a little bit only goes a little way, and the only thing that goes a long way is a lot. It takes a lot of talent, a lot of treasure, a lot of time to solve some of these problems on the scale that they exist. So, again, if you think of 300 to 500 million people being infected by malaria and a million kids dying from it across the African continent and part of Asia, that's a huge, huge issue. And so how do you create the public health infrastructure? How do you create the delivery systems? And so many times I think the best minds involved in any issue have been involved in kind of coming up with a solution, but then they haven't stayed involved as a business person would, for example. If you invented a better product or a better mousetrap, if you were in Silicon Valley and you came up with a better piece of software, you would get investors to help you scale that up. That's where all of your attention would turn. We need to do the same thing in the public sector now, and I think a lot of social entrepreneurs, if you look at people like Wendy Kopp, who started Teach for America, somebody like that, they had an idea, and they realized that they had to do more than invent the idea. They had to invest the resources to build their capacity to scale it up.
Isn't that one of the big changes that we're seeing across the board in philanthropy today, this idea that in many ways the market model, the for-profit model, and the metrics that are used to measure those things can be applied to the nonprofit world?
Absolutely. They need to be applied to the nonprofit world. As I mentioned a little bit earlier, this notion that most nonprofits exist to fill a gap that the markets have left. There's no market. There's no economic market for coming up with a malaria vaccine. There's no economic market for feeding hungry kids. And so you have to find proxies for that, and you have to use business principles. You have to use market forces. Find a way to bring those to your disposal. In fact, one of the things we realized at Share Our Strength many years ago is that nonprofit organizations, often in the course of pursuing their mission, create an asset that has a real marketplace value. And if they can leverage that, they can be an organization that not only redistributes wealth, which is what we think of as most nonprofits doing, but actually creates wealth. That's what we've tried to do at Share Our Strength. We have cause-related marketing partnerships. We have corporate partnerships. We have licensing deals so that you don't just fight for your share of the charitable pie. You make that pie grow.
But that's a relatively recent phenomenon. For a long time, it was thought that there had to be this proverbial wall between the market side and the nonprofit side, and to the extent that both could merge together to do good, that there was something wrong with that, something unclean about that.
I think that's exactly the way people thought of it. Now I think people are starting to realize that there's simply not enough charitable and philanthropic dollars to go around. Even if you doubled or tripled your fundraising, for example, we're never going to out-fundraise hunger. We've got to find other ways to solve that problem and other ways to bring new wealth to bear in achieving it.
Talk a little bit about some of the other people that you talk about in the book, in the imaginations of unreasonable men, some of the people that are really using their imagination to do this amazing work.
Yeah, another great example right in the Bay Area of California is Jay Kiesling, who's at UC Berkeley, and he's doing something very similar to what Steve Hoffman is doing on the vaccine side, except Jay Kiesling is doing it on the medicinal side, which is he has figured out a way to create a synthetic form of the most effective anti-malarial medicine that exists, the most effective medicine that's not really subject to drug resistance on the part of the malaria parasite, is called artemisinin. It's very rare. It's very expensive. And Jay Kiesling has figured out a way through synthetic biology to actually grow artemisinin, not in a factory, but inside a cell, inside a yeast cell or an E. coli cell. And so the idea is if you can create more supply, you can drop the price of it. Because right now, a course of artemisinin would cost somebody in Africa $2.40, and that's a huge amount of money. That's more than, you know, a day's or a week's wages for some people living in Africa. So Jay Kiesling, just like Steve Hoffman, said, you know what, we actually have something that works. We need to focus on how to scale that up, and he's created a process to do that, and very effectively.
What is it that motivates guys like this to do the research that they're doing, which is long and arduous and painstaking, and to do it in an arena where they know it is not market-driven, as we're seeing so much of in the research and medical field these days?
Well, that's a good question, and I tried to get to some of that in this book and really understand what is inside these folks. Clearly, there's a strong humanitarian impulse, but I think there's also this driving sense that you see in a lot of great achievements, what I think of as good is not good enough. You see somebody who has said, well, the fact that medicines are available for $2.40 a dose, and most people can't afford even 10 cents a dose, that means that good is not good enough. In Steve Hoffman's case, there are vaccines that large pharmaceuticals are working on that would be maybe effective 50% of the time. Well, that's good if it saves 500,000 lives, but it's not good enough. And so I think there's that driving sense that we can do better. And again, this ability to imagine a future that doesn't exist yet, but is within our grasp, and not to be intimidated by all the risks that you have to take to get there, the innovations you have to pursue to get there.
I want to come back to this other idea, because this sometimes gets mixed up in this whole notion of markets versus the nonprofit arena, which is that these things that are needed are not necessarily, as you've said, a failure of the marketplace, that in fact these are things that the marketplace is just not going to pursue on its own.
That's right. And if you can find ways to make the market work for you, if you can find these intersections between public interest and private interest, if you can look for them, if you can search them out, if you can say, I'm willing to be held accountable to market forces, because market forces are very unforgiving. They help you make a profit, or you can also lose money. But if you're willing to be accountable to them, I think you can really bring, as I say, new resources into a field that is always dependent only on philanthropic or government resources.
People like Dr. Hoffman and Jay Kisling talk about how they see the economic side of this and where they look and what their concerns are with respect to where the money's going to come from to continue this research.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that's so important about their work, because I think many times in the social sector, we try to develop the best possible product that can be developed, but we don't always think about what the economics are. And so to build the economics in from the beginning, to say that if I can't develop this for a dollar a dose or for 10 cents a dose, I ought not to develop it at all, because, you know, what good would it do if it doesn't actually get to people, is very important. Both Steve Hoffman and Jay Kisling, though, also decided to pursue their work through the for-profit sector. They created biotech companies. They could have done this through government. They could have done it through academia, but they realized they could bring investment capital and capital to work here. They could, in effect, create a market where one hasn't existed. One of the things that the Gates Foundation and former President Clinton has worked on is the idea of creating something called advanced market commitments, so that you get countries around the world, governments around the world, to say, if a vaccine is developed that through trials turns out to be 100% effective or close, we commit in advance to spend $50, $100, $200 million to buy it. That way, a developer knows that there will be a market for it, even if that market doesn't exist today.
As we see larger and larger foundations that are taking this more metric-oriented approach, like the Gates Foundation, Clinton Global Initiative, etc., talk about the broader impact that that's having, because that is also a relatively new phenomenon. And the other side of it is the impact that it's having downstream on smaller organizations that were doing this work before that in some ways are being co-opted by the larger institutions.
Yes, well, I think almost all organizations in the nonprofit sector now are starting to have to think about how do they measure their impact, how do they measure their outcomes, how do they actually reserve some of their funding to deploy it for those purposes of measuring impact and communicating it, because the nonprofit sector in the past had not operated as a responsive marketplace. If you're in a business and you build a better product or have a better service, the market rewards you. And if it's an inferior product or service, the market penalizes you. It hasn't always worked that way in the nonprofit sector, because it's very hard to measure the impact that some organizations are having. And there's no apples-to-apples measure. So you don't know if you have $1,000 to invest, are you better off investing it in Share Our Strength or Teach for America or City Year? Where do you get the greatest return? It's been hard to tell. Now there are some online measurement tools like Charity Navigator and GuideStar. They're not perfect, but they give you a sense of how efficient and effective these organizations are. But there's also a commitment, I think, on the part of a lot of nonprofit and philanthropic leaders to be transparent and be accountable and to invest in measuring what types of impact they're having. So we, for example, at Share Our Strength, we've been able to say, you know, we're going to end childhood hunger. We'll know we're successful when we've increased the percentage of these kids enrolled in these programs. And every year we're able to actually measure and show, did we go up or we go down? And our investors and our supporters can make judgments about us based on that.
And talk about in Africa with respect to malaria and some of the success and failures along the way.
Well, it's been a roller coaster throughout history with the malaria parasite. Just to give you a sense of how complex it is, the HIV virus has about 10 to 13 genes that comprise that virus. The single-celled malaria parasite has 5,300 genes. And so every time science has brought something to bear to eradicate it, the malaria parasite has mutated. If just one of those genes mutate, it becomes safe from what we're in effect throwing at it. So it's been a roller coaster, and there have been times where we've been closer than ever before to actually eliminating malaria, and then it's come back strong. Now there's a confluence of activities that have to do with prevention through bed nets, insecticide-treated bed nets, which is spreading rapidly across Africa. It's having an impact, but the mosquito is again adapting. It's now starting to bite earlier in the day, not waiting until people go to sleep at night. But in addition to bed nets, there are new courses of medicine. There are these vaccine trials. So we're close, but we shouldn't be overly optimistic that we can let our guard down. It'll take years and years of really collaboration to end malaria.
And, of course, all of these things come with their own unintended consequences. Even if malaria could be wiped out, there's infrastructure issues and population issues and things that change in the dynamic of the place that have to be dealt with, too.
That's right, and a lot of it has to do with the quality of governance in African countries and in Asian countries, because you have to have governance that is willing to set up a public health structure. We can almost imagine the day that we will have a vaccine that's effective, but it will be tragic that we're not able to deliver it to everybody that needs it. That requires refrigeration and transportation and things like that. So there's a lot of multitasking problems to solve here at the same time.
And are there things that are overlapping in all of these? Are there some problems, for example, in the infrastructure, in the delivery side, to things like dealing with malaria that are not dissimilar from some of the food problems to children that we talked about earlier in terms of the logistics inherent in that? Are there economies of scale that we can learn from in all of these cross-platform problems?
Yes, I think you've put your finger on it. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I was so eager to study and learn about these global health issues and these malaria issues, because I thought that there were lessons there that could be learned for all of the work that we do on the social change side. Some of those lessons have to do with the fact that solutions exist and the challenge is to scale them up. Some of those lessons have to do with we need to build the economics in from the beginning, not retrofit the economic model in at the end. Some of it has to do with kind of the failure of imagination that we talked about. And I think a lot of it has to do, and we see this in every issue we face here in the United States or around the world, which is that we can't deal with these issues in isolation. You can't solve the malaria problem without also dealing with some economic issues, some anti-poverty issues, some infrastructure issues.
What about the political issues? You know, you mentioned a moment ago the governance within these African countries, but in a broader sense, whether it's the political issues here in the States, United Nations issues, or governance in these African nations, to what extent is the politics a key part of this equation?
Well, I would argue that with an issue like malaria, the challenge is as much political as it is scientific. So we still have a lot of science to do, but because the victims are so, in effect, so voiceless, so economically marginalized, that they don't have a voice, they don't have a representative to speak for them, you tend to see resources not being allocated in their direction. Same thing we see here at home with kids who are hungry in the United States. These are among the most voiceless people in our country, and so they don't have lobbyists. They don't have people making PAC contributions to governors and senators saying, please focus on this issue. And so to get the attention of policymakers, to create a political constituency on behalf of the voiceless, I think is one of the toughest challenges. So you're absolutely right. This is as much of a political issue as it is a science issue or a policy issue.
We've talked about imagination. I want to talk a little bit about persistence, because there are setbacks along the way. I'm sure you've had setbacks along the way in dealing with childhood hunger, as they will be setbacks for these scientists in dealing with these vaccines. Talk about the persistence that is dogged enough to work through those.
Yeah, that's part of, I think, what makes the unreasonable man or woman unreasonable, but in the best sense of the word, which is because they just keep going. Steve Hoffman is a good example. He's had one reversal after another over 20 years, but he's learned from each one. Each one has made his vaccine better. So when I had first met him, he had found that he could extract from the mosquito an extraordinarily large number of malaria parasites, which are the critical ingredient for his vaccine, because he radiates them to weaken them, and then he does that. So it seemed like a huge victory at the time. Then it turned out in the very first phase of his trials, when he injected this into people, it was almost impossible to know at first what the right dose was. So the objective of first phase of clinical trials is always just safety. Make sure that the injection, the vaccine, doesn't make you sicker than it does healthier. And so it was very good on safety, but it turned out to be very ineffective. He had to go back to the drawing board. He's now looking at other ways to administer it. Almost anybody, you know, in science, Thomas Edison once said, I haven't failed. I've found 10,000 new ways not to do what I'm trying to do. So if you can take that kind of, you know, learning from what you do and apply it, you can go forward.
Bill Shaw, the book is The Imaginations of Unreasonable Men, Inspiration, Vision, and Purpose in the Quest to End Malaria. Bill, I thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.